He responded with fervent and with reverent belief, with fervent and reverent conviction. And it doesn't seem like it would really matter who you are, whether you were one of the 11 who was there with him every day, or one of us who's years later, or even someone who's very skeptical, an atheist. To be able to do that and to see that, experience that, seems like you'd have to respond that way. Of course, we likely will never be afforded any type of opportunity close to that. And if we continue reading verse 29, Jesus addresses that, the group that we would be in. Verse 29, Jesus says to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." And so this is you and me. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. And so why is it that we believe? And why should others believe? Is there a good reason that we could give to others? And of course, in Timothy, in 1 Timothy chapter 3, he tells us there that we need to always be ready to give an answer or to make a defense to anyone who asks for a reason of the hope that is in us. And so he says that we need to be ready to give a defense of the reason. And so what is the reason that we believe? And of course, answering that for Thomas, that was clear. Now he had a reason, and he had a reason he could go and he could tell other people. Now those who, maybe ridicule Christianity, when they refer to hope and faith, oftentimes they refer to it in such a way like that's what hope and faith is believing in something for no reason and for no cause. And unfortunately, much of the Christian community has adopted that, and that's infiltrated into their mindset. Hopefully not into our mindset, but into the mindset that it's almost even a token of how strong our faith is. Like, I believe even though I don't have a reason to. Or kind of like we might think of ourselves as doubting Thomas, like if we were to look for a reason to believe, that is saying that, we're kind of taking the attitude of Thomas, well, I'm not going to believe unless you just kind of hand it to me on a platter. And so we're not doing our part as a Christian to kind of step out on that limb and do our part and believe. And that's how sometimes it's thought of. But, that's not what Peter says. He says to have a reason and be able to give an answer, make a defense of that reason to someone else. And he says, always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. That's 1 Peter 3:15. And the King James Version says answer. Be ready to give an answer. That's the ESV that I'm reading out of tonight. And I like the word defense that it uses because it kind of denotes this power and substance behind it. But he says, with gentleness and respect. So he's not talking about like a hostile type of defense, but it's more like an attorney or a lawyer who goes and makes a defense on a case. And an attorney or a lawyer doesn't really just show up and tell the jury or the judge that, well, I believe that this man is innocent, and so I think that you should also believe that this man is innocent. Instead, he takes a very methodical process to lay out the facts and the logic to build a case that this man is innocent. And he does that in such a way to be able to persuade the judge and the jury that this man is innocent. And so I believe that's what Peter says when he says, make a defense with gentleness and with respect. In a gentle, respectful way, lay out the facts in a logical way so that people can see the reason you have for the hope that lies within you. And that's what we're called to do. And that's what, if you think about Thomas afterwards, he would be able to do that. He would be able to explain to someone, here are the reasons that I believe. And whether they believe, whether they agreed with him or not, you would have to think that anyone would be able to respect where he comes from and the hope that lies within him. Even if they came to disagree with him, they couldn't fault him for the reason that he believed in it. And so if we continue reading there, John chapter 20 and verse 30, it says, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in His name. So like I said, we weren't there to experience those miracles like John was and like Thomas was. But just like John says there, he couldn't write down all the things that Jesus did, but these were written so that we might believe. Blessed are those who believe without seeing. And that's the very reason that he documented those things, so that we can make a ready defense for the hope that is in us. I'd like you to go to Luke chapter 16, if you will. And this is the story of the rich man who asks Abraham to give his brothers essentially a reason to believe. They didn't believe, they had faltered away, and so he wanted Abraham to give them a reason to believe. And the story kind of starts there in verse 19, and it tells of how a rich man and Lazarus lived together, and Lazarus ate from the crumbs of his table, and they both died, and the rich man went to torments, and Lazarus was carried up by the angels into Abraham's bosom to be comforted. And while in torments, he asked Father Abraham, please send Lazarus over that he may dip his finger in water and touch it to my tongue, that my tongue may be cool. And Abraham says, no, you're reaping what you've sown, and he's reaping what he's sown, essentially. And he says, besides this, there's a great gulf between us. And so then he asks in verse 27. If you go to verse 27, then the rich man proceeds to ask Abraham of something else. He says, and he said, then I beg you, Father, to send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, so that he may warn them, lest they also come into this place of torment. So, unlike Thomas, this rich man was making a similar request as Thomas. Thomas said, I'm not going to believe unless I can see a resurrection from the dead. And this rich man is making a similar request, but he's not asking it of himself. He's asking it for his five brothers. And, you know, like Thomas, what possible response could they have if Lazarus, I don't know if they knew Lazarus or not, but a man rises from the dead and he goes to him and says, look, guys, this is what it's all about. The evidence would be so overwhelming that we would assume, just like Thomas, they would almost have to respond with fervent, reverent belief. And so I imagine all of us can put this into context, where we have loved ones who either don't believe, never have believed, or who have fallen away from the faith. And so I imagine all of us can pick out one person like that who we love dearly, who we care about dearly, who has fallen or has never believed and is not in a good place. And think about being in the rich man's situation there with Abraham. Wouldn't we love to be able to ask Abraham of the same thing? You know, send someone back from the dead. And so, you know, especially someone, you know, in my own family tree, if I'm thinking about someone, it's like, well, you know, my mother has died, my grandfather has died. So someone in my family tree who's fallen away, wouldn't it be something if one of them, my mom or my grandpa or someone who they're acquainted with, who they know, was able to come back from the dead and say, look, this is what it's all about. Wake up. How could they respond? I mean, in my mind, almost by necessity, it would have to be with fervent, reverent belief. Could you think of a better way to convict or to convert someone? Well, let's continue on reading there in Luke 16 and verse 29. It says, but Abraham said, they have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them. And he said, no, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent. So Abraham's first response back is like, no, they have Moses and the prophets. Of course, he's referring there to the writings of Moses and the prophets, which we would consider the Old Testament. They have Moses and the prophets. That's enough. And, of course, the rich man replies back, no, you don't understand. You know, if they had someone who rose from the dead, that would really turn them around, and that would convert them. So if we go to the next verse, verse 31, Abraham replies back, and he said to him, if they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced if someone should rise from the dead. Think about that response for a minute. I believe that verse, Luke 16:31, is one of the most powerful verses in the entire Bible. If they won't believe Moses and the prophets, they're not going to be convinced even if someone should rise from the dead. I think that tells us two pretty important things. One is that some people are just not going to believe. It's not a matter of the evidence. It's not a matter of the proof. They're just not going to believe. And I believe that's why in Matthew chapter 11, and then also in the first several chapters of Revelations chapter 2, chapter 3, when talking to the churches there in Revelations, and at the end of every letter to the church, Jesus says, and then like I said in Matthew as well, he says, to those who have ears, let them hear. To he who has an ear, let him hear. Some people don't have an ear to hear. And so some people are not afforded that opportunity to hear and to have that open heart, I believe. And so some people, it just won't matter. But for the rest, that tells us that the writings of Moses and the prophets, like I said, what we would call the Old Testament, it gives us every bit as much of convincing matter as someone rising from the dead. It's just as powerful as someone rising from the dead. So if someone was going to believe, we already have everything that we need to believe. If you go to Isaiah chapter 48, we can see that this was God's intent with his writings. Just like John said, these are written down so that others may believe. That was God's intent for all of his scripture. But Isaiah 48, starting verse 3, makes this very, very clear. God, through the prophet Isaiah, says, the former things I declare of old, they went out from my mouth, and I announced them. Then suddenly I did them, and they came to pass. Because I know that you are obstinate, and your neck is an iron sinew, and your forehead brass. I declare them to you from of old. Before they came to pass, I announced them to you, lest you should say, my idol did them, my carved image, and my metal image commanded them. So this is sufficient enough to convict even those who are obstinate or who have a stiff neck. He says, this is why I'm doing it, because you're obstinate and you have a stiff neck. Of course, we know that later, you know, that many of the prophets, as Jesus told them, were stoned by the scribes and the Pharisees. And so some of them were too obstinate and had too much of a stiff neck. And we know that it was powerful enough, and that was the intent that it was given for, but even it, like I said, some people weren't able to. But in the prophecy, he tells them, you know, concerning prophecy here, he's telling them, I'm going to tell you exactly what I'm going to make happen, and then I'm going to make it happen exactly that way, so that there's no doubt in your mind that it didn't just happen by chance, or you can't give credit to something else. You can't give credit to your idol or anything. And so if someone won't believe this, then, you know, it's like what Abraham said. I don't believe they would even believe, even if someone rose from the dead. And, of course, we saw that with Jesus. When Jesus, you know, he died and rose from the dead, and it converted many, and many believed. But even that, there were many people involved, you know, there in Jerusalem and everything, who did not become believers. If you go to Luke chapter 24, I want to look at that. Several passages here where Jesus, after his death and burial and resurrection, he comes back and he reveals himself to people. And I want to examine how he reveals himself and the responses that he had. Luke chapter 24, and when it starts in verse 21, there when they buried him, they were rushing to bury him right before the Sabbath started, and there were two, as I understand it, two back-to-back Sabbaths, and so they weren't able to go back and attend to his body properly until Sunday morning. That was when the Sabbaths were over. And so that's why he was in the ground for 3 days with no attention. And so they came back first thing right as it was getting light, Sunday morning, to prepare his body with these spices and whatnot for a proper burial. And so the women show up, and of course the stone's rolled back, and he's gone, and there's an angel there who talks to him and tells him, why are you seeking the living with the dead? And he goes and he tells them what's going to happen there, or what has happened with Jesus. And so the women run back and they tell the apostles, the disciples there. And it says that, you know, they kind of took it up as just a fable. That you know, they didn't really know what to think about what these women were telling him. But Peter, he ran back and looked and he marveled at what he saw. And then later there were a couple of people walking along the road, and they were talking about all these events that had happened. Remember that it happened, it occurred during the Passover, and there were thousands and thousands of Jews from all over the countryside in Jerusalem at that time. It was a huge event, and you know, Jesus was a big thing at that. You know, during that event, he'd been working many miracles, and so everyone was kind of aware of what was going on. They're walking along the road talking about it, and Jesus shows up, and it says that their eyes, though, were made so they couldn't recognize him. And so Jesus says, "What are you talking about?" And they said, "Are you serious? Are you the only person in Jerusalem who doesn't know about the events?" And he says, "What events?" And so then they go and they start explaining to him everything that happened. And yeah, there's this great prophet who was doing all these wonderful things, and they turned him over and crucified him. And we thought this guy was the one. We thought he was going to be the one who restored Israel. And in verse 25, I want to skip down to 25 and see how Jesus responds to him. He says, "And he said to them, 'O foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself.'" So, you know, how does he, when he reveals himself, how does he tie that back to them? And how does he talk to them about that? He goes back to Moses and the prophets, and it says, "Beginning with Moses and all the prophets." That's all the books of the Bible. Moses was a prophet, but he calls Moses out separate. But, you know, we often accredit the first five books to Moses, and the rest are to the prophets. And later we'll see here, just further down, that he also calls out the Psalms as well. But beginning with Moses and all the prophets. So every book of the Bible, he interpreted to them in all the scripture the things concerning himself. So throughout all the scripture, throughout all of the Old Testament, he went through and explained to them, this was talking about me. This was me. This is where you see me. And that's how he relates himself to them at his resurrection, when he comes back and shows himself to them. And he calls them, he says, "You were foolish to not to not recognize these things." So if you skip down there to verse 44, this is where, of course, that was there on the road with the two, and then this is with the apostles. Luke 24 and 44, it says, "Then he said to them, 'These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled.' Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures." So these folks, you know, most of them, well, all of them had been with Jesus for 3 years. So all of them should have gotten pretty well acquainted with a lot of the writings of Moses and the prophets. Most of them, I'm sure, were very well acquainted with the writings before that 3 years. But the point is, they knew the writings of Moses and the prophets, but they didn't understand it. They didn't understand the mystery of God's plan, the eternal purpose of God's plan, and how Jesus related to that. They didn't understand it fully anyways. And so for all those years, they thought that, you know, the Old Testament, maybe they thought that the Old Testament was history and laws and practices, and that's what it contained. And so here, though, it says that he opened their minds, verse 45, "Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures." So he opened their mind to understand the Old Testament, to show them what the Old Testament was about. That it was about him. That it was about Jesus and all the scriptures, all the books, every single book. Have you all seen the movie The Sixth Sense? Wayland says no, and probably disapprovingly. No, maybe not. It's an old movie, like I'm guessing, I'm thinking back in the 90s, right? And so, really old. Well, what I mean is it's about, you know, I'm guessing somewhere around 20 years old. Time flies. I was just thinking and telling my dad the other day, we were talking, it's like, you know, I was thinking about that on the way out here, how long it's been since I've been here in the building, you know, worshiping with y'all. But I was telling my dad the other day, I've lived a third of my life in Texas. When I left Durango, I thought I'd be back in like, you know, 2 years. Now a third of my life. And I'm back. So anyways, time flies. It seems like The Sixth Sense just came out. So anyways, the movie, the premise of the movie is this little boy sees dead people. And of course, because of that, he's really disturbed. And he has a lot of emotional and psychological problems. And so one of the main characters is Bruce Willis. And he's a psychiatrist or a counselor who is really working hard trying to counsel this little boy. So he's working with the mother, and he's working with the teachers and different things, really trying to coach this little boy along. And then you get almost to the very end of the movie, and you realize, and Bruce Willis himself, he didn't realize this, but he realizes, he comes to find out that he's been dead the entire movie. He was one of the dead people that the little boy could see. And so, you know, the viewers, it's like this huge aha moment. And so you always, like, would hear people. I remember back then, you know, everyone's like, oh, I figured it out right at this time. And that was kind of the big thing. You know, this is when I figured it out, is at this moment, I knew what was going on. And, you know, and I can still remember, like I said, 20 years ago, and I can still remember right where, you know, what happened in the movie that I was like, whoa, he's been dead this whole time? And, of course, like I said, he didn't even know it. And so it was, you know, just this huge aha moment. And you had to almost kind of go back then after that and watch it again to look for all the clues that were laid down in the whole movie. And then, of course, after that, you could never watch it the same way that you did the first time. Because as you watch it, of course, you know the ending, and you're looking at all these little clues and all these little things that were going on. Well, go to John chapter 1, and this is kind of how, I mean, this is exactly how, and I heard another person compare the Old Testament to The Sixth Sense, and it kind of stuck with me. I thought that it was an interesting comparison, but that's how the Old Testament is. We, you know, you can read it along and not understand what it's about, and then all of a sudden there's this big reveal, and it's like, oh. And then from then on, you know, you have a different perspective. And I think that's what, you can almost see that happening with the disciples and with the apostles here. They go along, they knew the scripture, they'd been with Jesus for 3 years, and then it says that I read in verse 45, then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures after he had explained in every book how it pertained to him. So, in 1 John chapter 1, verse 1, it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And if you skip down, it goes on and talks about how John the Baptist came testifying of that word, that light. And if you skip down to verse 14, it says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen His glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. So it's not that Moses and the prophets just wrote about the future Jesus. It's not that they just wrote about how Jesus would eventually come. Jesus existed then, and His fingerprint existed then. He was in the beginning with the Lord, with God, at creation. And God, when God spoke to bring about creation. And all things were created for Him and by Him, as we're told here and also in Colossians chapter 1. And so Jesus' fingerprint was on everything. He existed then, and He was there in existence in the world. It said, in Him was life, and that life was the light of men. And so, you know, through Moses and the prophets, the light that was in them, where did that light come from? What was that light? That was Jesus shining. That was the Word. And then finally, the Word had been there ever since the beginning, and the Word was there in creation. And so its fingerprint, its existence, is not just spoken of in a future tense by Moses and the prophets, but it was there with Moses and the prophets throughout all of their life and throughout that whole duration, throughout all their writings. And then it came to us in the form of flesh. Glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. So, this is kind of a good description of John's aha moment, right? So think about John there, where we read in Luke, he's sitting there and Jesus comes and it says, so Jesus went back and explained in all Moses and the prophets and Psalms, He explained Himself through all the Scriptures and He opened their eyes so that they understood the Scriptures. Okay, that happened, you know, shortly after Jesus rose. And then, of course, John wrote this gospel years later. And so John's sitting here like thinking, okay, I'm going to write a gospel of the events. How do I start this book? Where do I even start? And you know what he did? He kind of, like, how he opens there is kind of like me saying, oh, you know what? I watched this really good movie this last weekend. You should go see it. It's called The Sixth Sense. By the way, the main character's dead the whole time. That's kind of how John starts his book. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So, hey, yeah, you should go and read the Old Testament, but before you read it, I'm going to kind of ruin it for you. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And so it's like he's had this big aha moment, and you can almost see like the apostles, you know, talking among themselves as Jesus is describing all these events in the Old Testament and explaining all these things. You can almost kind of see, hey, you know, when I got it right here at this moment when Jesus, you know, was telling me that. That's when it finally clicked with me what these writings were about, what Moses and the prophets were actually talking about. And so, just like I was saying, you can almost imagine that after that time, all of them have been acquainted, right, with the writings of the Old Testament. But you can almost see, like after Jesus says, open their minds, open their eyes so they can understand the Scriptures. And then he leaves, and they're left there. I mean, what would you have done? I can almost just, you know, see them like, man, I got to get my hands on some of those scrolls and everything. I've got to reread this. And then when they read it, they could never read it like they used to. They would never be able to go through those writings with the same mindset that they had previous. Because everywhere they look, everything they read, everywhere they turn, they're going to see the fingerprint of the Word of God. Everywhere they look, everywhere they read, they're going to see the life that was shown as the light of men. And they're going to recognize it, be able to recognize it for what it was, for what it is, Christ. And so we're kind of the same way. Once we get this, and we have this aha moment of what the Old Testament is really about, it changes how we read it. And we almost have to go back and read it again. In my mind, I don't think there's any really basis for this breakdown, but in my mind, there's kind of two different categories of prophecy, or, you know, the revealing of Christ. There's some verses that are just, you know, very kind of to the point and, you know, specific and everything. And examples of those are like in Micah 5:2, it tells us that he was going to be born of Bethlehem. In Psalms 41:9 and 55:12 through 14, it tells us he's going to be betrayed by a friend. In Zechariah 11, verses 12 through 13, it tells us that he was going to be sold for 30 pieces of silver. The money was going to be thrown into God's house, and the money was going to be used to buy a potter's field. In Psalms 22:16 and Zechariah 12:10, it tells us that his hands and feet were going to be pierced. In Isaiah 53:12, it tells us that he was going to be crucified with thieves. In Psalms 22:18, it tells us that his garments were going to be parted and lots were going to be cast. In Psalm 69:21, it tells us that he was going to be thirsty and was going to be given vinegar. In Psalms 34:20, it tells us that none of his bones would be broken. In Zechariah 12:10, it tells us that his side was going to be pierced. In Isaiah 53:9, it tells us that he was going to be buried in a rich man's tomb. That's just 12 prophecies that, in my mind, are, you know, very powerful because, and of course, we, you know, I'm not going to turn and read the fulfilling of all those in the New Testament. I think all of us know and have read how all of those things were fulfilled. That's just 12 very specific prophecies about Christ. That, as you know, as you can kind of hear Abraham say, if they're not going to believe Moses and the prophets, and like God said in Isaiah, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen, I'm going to make it happen that way, so that you can't accredit it to anything else but to me. So you can kind of hear, you know, Moses and God and everyone saying, if they don't believe Moses and the prophets, what are they going to believe? But the other thing, so those are kind of short, specific sentence type of prophecies. The other thing is what I would call kind of event type of prophecies, where there's not a little sentence that says, this is how it's going to be, but there's an entire event that occurs that the very way that it occurs is to shadow or foretell how Christ is going to come to us. And so a good example of that is a few years ago I came and I spoke about the Passover, and we broke it down, I think, into three sermons, maybe two. I've done it different, but we spent our whole first day just looking at like the writings of Leviticus and all these Old Testaments. We kind of really got into all this Old Testament law, and it kind of can be tough to go through. But then when you start going into Christ, you see that this entire event, essentially, God said, okay, you're in Egypt, and I'm going to deliver you from slavery, and I'm going to deliver you from death, and I'm going to show you how I'm going to deliver you from slavery and death. And he did it exactly how he's going to deliver all of us from slavery and death through Christ. And so that whole event of how he took people out of Egypt and freed them, he did specifically to show us how he's going to take us and remove us and free us from the bondages of sin. And so that's an entire event that takes, you know, chapters and chapters and chapters to show the fulfillment of that prophecy. And then, of course, there are certain things, like just like I said, that none of his bones would be broken. Well, that's kind of a part of that event, that none of the Passover lamb's bones were allowed to be broken. And so there's a lot of specific items there, too, but the event at large is what I was talking about. In Hebrews chapter 8, and starting there in verse 1, it's talking about the priests. I guess we'll just read in verse 1, picking up in verse 1, Hebrews 8 and 1. It says, now the point in what we are saying is this: we have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, and the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, see that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain. But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. So, in verse 5, it says they serve a copy. So these things, all the things that the priests did and the law, they serve a copy and a shadow of heavenly things. And you've heard some translations say an example, some translations say a type. You've heard types and shadows. They serve as a type or a shadow. And then he goes and he gives an example right after that in verse 5. He says, right after, in verse 5, they serve as a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain. So sometimes when we're reading through, you know, Leviticus and different books like that, and we're reading how all of the detail of how Moses was to build and put together the tabernacle, then it can kind of be like, whoa, you know, this is boring, or how does this apply to me, or something. But God didn't give him all, I mean, think about that. Why would God even care, like, you know, give him all the little detail? You're going to have a little, you know, it's got to be this color, and it's got to be made out of this type of thread, and this is how long it's going to be, and this is how high it's going to be. Why would he care, and why would he go into that detail? He didn't care about the physical, right? But he was telling Moses all these specific dimensions and instructions because it was a shadow, it was an example, it was a type of something else, of something spiritual, of something heavenly. And that's what it served as. In Hebrews 10:1 says, "For since the law has but a shadow of good things to come." So the law, too, was a shadow of the good things to come. We can read through Deuteronomy and think about how, you know, all those things, they go into all these details, but it was a shadow of things that were to come. Colossians 2 and 16 and 17 tells of how the festivals and new moons and Sabbaths were a shadow, and it says, but the substance is Christ. And of course, we covered that, if you remember, back when I did talk on the Passover, how Christ is a substance. Every shadow has a substance that there has to be an object that casts that shadow. And so if we make a shadow with a flashlight on our hand, we can see that hand, and we can count the fingers on the hand, we can identify it, but there has to be an object to cast that shadow. And in Colossians 2, it says the substance is Christ. Christ was that object. And so kind of through the whole Old Testament, you can see this shadow, all these shadows of things throughout the Old Testament, but there was someone who existed that whole time, and it was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word came to us in the form of flesh. And so some of these, I would say, more subtle but bigger picture event type of prophecies in my mind are some of the ones that are more convicting than anything else. So for years and years and years, I remember I had a whiteboard at my room at my dad's house, and I would write ideas and different things up there. And for the longest time I had, why do we believe in God and in Christ and in the Bible? And I wanted to make sure that my faith was sincere, that I didn't believe just because that's how I was taught, but I also wanted to be able to tell others. And I was aware of those, like, more specific prophecies, but my faith really started to grow in the Old Testament once I kind of had that aha moment, that it wasn't, the Old Testament wasn't 95% law and history and practices, and then 5% just here and there, every once in a while, there's a prophecy about Christ. But it was 100% the foundation of Christ and the foreshadowing of Christ throughout, 100%. And so, you know, looking at some of those bigger picture, what I would call prophecies of Christ, seemed to have, in my opinion, had much more of an effect on me than some of those smaller, more specific ones. I'd like to turn to John chapter 5, and I want to just change a little bit as we close. Not only is the Old Testament, not only does it build our faith, but it demands that we recognize its authority. It's there to, just like, you know, just like Abraham said, if they don't believe Moses and the prophets, they're not going to believe even if someone rises from the dead. It's powerful enough to convict us. It's powerful enough to build our faith and to build our hope, and it can be the foundation of our faith and hope. And because of that, and because it's Christ throughout, it demands us to recognize its authority as well. And so, in John chapter 5, and He's talking here with the scribes and the Pharisees, and he's kind of coming down hard on them as far as on their belief. And so I want to skip to verse 46. He tells them, "For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote of me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words?" So many Christians today don't believe the Old Testament writings. You know, there are many Christians, many people who profess Christ, who don't believe the account of the flood as Moses wrote it, don't believe the account of creation. They don't believe what Moses wrote. And verse 47, Christ says, "But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words?" I want to give you a few examples of how Jesus and Peter, one example of how Peter validated specific events of Moses' writings that are now criticized. Matthew chapter 19, 4 and 6, and Mark 10, 6 and 8, Jesus quotes Moses from the creation account when they come to ask him about marriage. Luke 11, 5, Jesus refers to and validates the creation and Abel. In Matthew 10, 15, Jesus refers to and validates Sodom and Gomorrah. In Luke 17, 26 through 29, Jesus refers to and validates Noah and the flood, and then also Lot and Sodom. And then 2 Peter 3, 1, verses 1 through 7, Peter denounces those who don't believe the flood. He comes down on those who are willingly ignorant of the great deluge. And so, you know, Jesus and Peter, they referred back and quoted those passages and referred to those and validated the writings and the passages of Moses. And I want us to think, why do skeptics never point out that Jesus rising from the dead is an impossibility? You know, I never have heard anyone come to me anyways and say, you know, you believe that Jesus rose from the dead, but you realize that's not physically possible, right? No one's ever come to me and said that. And of course, it's like, well, that's the point, is that a man couldn't do that. It proves, and that's what Paul says in Romans chapter 1, that it's by this resurrection that God set to rest exactly who Jesus was and the authority of which he came and the power that he had. That's the whole point of it, right? But we would never allow anyone to attack that. We would never allow anyone to undermine the death and resurrection of Christ. But we can become much more comfortable with people undermining and attacking the writings of Moses and the writings of the prophets. And so if we undermine the Old Testament events, what are those implications? If we undermine the writings of Moses and the prophets, you know, in our church or in our home, in our workplace or anywhere, I mean, what are those implications? You know, how are our children supposed to respond? If we say, believe in Jesus, he died for you and he rose and he's the only way to salvation, it's imperative that you believe in Jesus, but yeah, creating the world in 6 days, that I don't see how that's possible. You know, physically, it's just not possible. But believe in Jesus rising from the dead, but it's just not possible that Moses put two of every animal on the ark. Or it's just not possible. There's not enough water to cover the entire earth. And so that's impossible. So it would be silly to believe in it, but believe in Jesus that he rose from the dead. That's the stance that many, many people take, many Christians take. And because maybe we're lazy in that regard, I think it's where Satan has often attacked, is the writings of Moses and the prophets. But its implications, I don't think, can be stated any better than verse 47. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? And so when we're teaching our children and we say, yeah, the writings of Moses, 6 days, the flood, no, you don't really need to believe that, but I still want you to believe in Christ. But if you do not believe in his writings, how will you believe my words? I think that question that he posed to them is just as relevant to us as it was to them back when he wrote it. So, you know, in conclusion, it's important for us to be just as convicted as Thomas was, with fervent and zealous conviction, reverent conviction. And we need to have reasons for that. We're told to have reasons for that, and we're told what those reasons are, and we're supposed to be able to make a defense, just like a lawyer, in a logical way. And we have at our fingertips something powerful to do that, something able to do that. We're not weak in this point. We have something sitting right here that Abraham says is just as powerful as if we can ask someone to rise from the dead and go have that conversation with our friend or with our family member. And the, like I said a minute ago, the Old Testament is not 95% just outdated stuff and then 5% intermittent, you know, showings of Christ or talkings of Christ. The entire thing is the foundation of God's eternal purpose. And that eternal purpose is salvation through Christ. And so Christ and the light that he brought into the world is spread throughout all of it. And then, of course, as we just spoke, if we undermine that foundation and the foretelling of that foundation, then we undermine Christ himself. We can't undermine one and not undermine Christ. So one of my favorite topics that I've studied and gone through is one of the most beneficial things that I've ever done is going through the Old Testament and just sitting with a blank piece of paper and just starting to sketch it out as I read through. What does this book say and how does this fit on a timeline? And building a timeline myself so that I actually understood how those events actually took place. And so they're not all just these bedtime stories that I've heard, but I don't know how they fit together. And so understanding the Old Testament, when I set out to do that, I didn't know that it was going to increase my faith, but it increased my faith more than any of my direct endeavors to increase my faith, to study faith, right? And so I'd encourage that. And then on Sunday, I'll be speaking on Sunday, and what I want to do is I want to pull out, just like I said, the Passover is kind of one of those big events, so on Sunday, that's what I want to do is I want to look at an actual event in the Old Testament that I never understood. I always had questions. It never made sense. There was just something in there that didn't click, and I never could really make sense of it until I understood what it was about, until I understood that it was actually about Christ, and then all of a sudden it made sense. And so that's what I want to talk about on Sunday. So I appreciate your attention tonight.